Welcome back to the program. We are reminded every day how polarized our politics has become. The gap between Republicans and Democrats is wider than ever. And the lack of bipartisanship is not because we have leaders of ill will, but because the gap in ideas and vision has become so wide. This is reflected in our elections, our news, in Congress, and in the Supreme Court of the United States. Barack Obama, our 44th president, and John Roberts, our 17th Chief Justice, are personalities that sit at the apex of that divide. This is the backdrop for Jeffrey Toobin's new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's a senior legal analyst at CNN, the best-selling author of the previous book about the court, The Nine. It is my pleasure to have Jeffrey Toobin here to talk about The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey Toobin, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Good to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. One of the things that I suppose is the most remarkable about this story is that in looking at the divide and looking at the partisanship on the court, the divisions, that in many ways it is Obama and the Democrats, but Obama more specifically, that represents the more traditional conservative position on so many of these issues before the court.
You know, that's the paradox really at the heart of my book, which is that Obama, who ran for office as the candidate of change, when it comes to the Constitution, is really the candidate of stability, and John Roberts is the candidate, as it were, of change. When you look at issues like abortion, affirmative action, civil rights, campaign finance, it is John Roberts and his conservative allies almost all the time pushing to change the law, where Obama and his allies are trying to say, hold on, let's just leave things the way they are.
In many ways, John Roberts represents a radical position.
Yeah, I mean, in certain ways, not in all. Certainly I would say that Citizens United is a radical decision and is a dramatic change from many years of constitutional law. I think abortion may be heading for a radical change, depending on future appointments. But this is why elections matter. The Supreme Court does not get talked about that much as an issue in campaigns, but it is, in many respects, the most important legacy that a president leaves, his or her appointees to the Supreme Court. And that's certainly true with George W. Bush. And it may turn out to be true with Barack Obama as well.
And in many ways, these changes, these ideas that John Roberts sits at the apex of, are ideas that conservatives on the court have been moving towards for a long time. That this is a long way, certainly from the Republican moderates that were on the court back in the Eisenhower-Nixon days, but this has been a progression for Republicans on the court.
Well, to me, the biggest development in American politics in the last 30, 40 years has been the evolution of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is simply more conservative than it used to be. And that is reflected in Congress, but especially in the Supreme Court as well. Moderate Republicans dominated the Supreme Court, whether it was Lewis Powell
Potter Stewart in the
1970s or Sandra Day O'Connor in the 80s and 90s. And today, those moderate Republicans are gone. In fact, Paul Stevens and David Souter, both Republican appointees, were so alienated from the modern Republican Party that they gave their seats on the Supreme Court to a Democrat, Barack Obama. And I think that tells you a lot about the state of the party in those days.
What does the Supreme Court tell us about the ideas that have been at the center of that movement within the Republican Party? Because many times we see it played out in Congress and in elections in terms of social issues, in part in terms of coalitions. But with respect to the court, there's been a very clear evolution in terms of ideas and philosophy.
Well, the idea that has been really ascendant in the conservative movement in the Supreme Court is originalism, which is the idea, very much associated with Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, that the Supreme Court, that the Constitution should be interpreted as the framers of the Constitution understood the words in the late 18th century, and that has led to decisions like the gun control decision, the Heller case of 2007, mm-hmm. which said that individuals have a constitutional right to bear arms. Citizens United in 2010, those are ideas that were very controversial, remain controversial, but because of conservative appointments to the Supreme Court, it's very hard for it's made a huge difference both politically and legally.
One of the things that you talk about is that even before John Roberts, who's the relative newcomer here, that Clarence Thomas really was one of the, even though we think of him as being so quiet, one of the most influential voices in pushing these ideas forward.
You know, that's really, you know, one of the paradoxes of Justice Thomas's career is that he is so well known for his silence on the bench that people somehow assume that he is somehow not important, not influential, not qualified. All false. Thomas has been extremely influential in bringing conservative ideas. Often he was alone, and often his ideas seemed outlandish when he first brought them. But with time and with conservative appointments, he has brought ideas to the court that have ultimately won majorities, whether it is the gun control case, which started mm-hmm. with the Thomas opinion, whether it was the ideas about the Commerce Clause that underlied the challenge to the Obamacare decision, which almost succeeded. Parts of Citizens United, ideas about free speech, came from Thomas. This is a man who has been enormously influential.
Talk a little bit about how John Roberts, in coming to the court, kind of adopted, reframed in some ways, some of these ideas in ways that would allow him to carry them even further.
Now, I think Roberts is more cautious than Scalia and, mm-hmm. and Thomas. I don't think he has pushed the ideas farther. But he has pushed the ideas, and he has been very successful, and we'll see how far he can get. A lot of that, of course, depends on who wins presidential elections and which justices resign at which time.
Right. And maybe with Roberts it's just that because he appears, his persona is one that is more temperate or more moderate, that it gives a different patina to some of this.
I think that is certainly the case. I think it is not a that Roberts' personality, certainly as reflected in his confirmation hearings, where he was so graceful and elegant in his expression, gave people the impression that he was more moderate than he really is. You know, I think liberals are. There's a certain arrogance about liberals, and they see someone like John Roberts, and they say he's so intelligent, he's so articulate, he's so he's such a good representative of what a judge should be. He must be liberal. Well, he's all those things, and he's very conservative.
And yet, the health care case, the Affordable Care Act, was a way in which Roberts further bolstered that impression in a way that arguably will make his conservative agenda even more effective going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have to admit here that, you know, I was completely wrong in how I saw that case turning out. And so I have had the opportunity to go back in the oath to figure out what happened, but I don't want to give you the impression that sort of I knew it all along that Roberts was going to vote the way he did, because I certainly did not know it all along. I was shocked at his judgment in that case. I do think it's important that Roberts understood the political context of that case, that it was so politically incendiary that if on top of Bush v. Gore, on top of Citizens United, the court 5-4 would again render a deeply political opinion with the Republicans arrayed unanimously, that would be tremendously damaging to the court's reputation, and I think Roberts wanted to avoid that at all costs, and he did. You know, as for whether the opinion is a bomb that could go off later and hurt liberal causes, I'm not sure. I have my doubts. I know. I've thought that was a possibility, but upon reflection, I'm not sure. I think that the significance of that case is the result, which is that Obamacare survived, and I think that's what really matters.
Is there significance in that it gives Roberts further carte blanche for more divided decisions going forward, for more politically incendiary, perhaps, decisions going forward because of the salve of how affordable health care went down?
Well, I do think he generated a lot of political space for himself. He saw that it is a huge, it was a huge victory for Democrats. And it did give him political space. I think, you know, he will never, in his many decades of work to follow, be accused of being a political hack because of what he did on the Obamacare case. So I think it's a big change. It gives him a lot of political space to do whatever he wants in subsequent cases, mm-hmm. and I expect that will be highly conservative in most circumstances.
How much of it was also, and you talk about Scalia and Alito overreaching and wanting to throw everything out, not just the individual mandate?
I think that was definitely a part of it. The Affordable Care Act was, as has often been pointed out, a 2,000-page law. Only a significant but small part of it was the individual mandate, the idea that people had to buy health insurance, and that was what was constitutionally controversial. If they had thrown out the whole law just based on that one part of it, it would have been such an example of judicial overreaching that I think it's just something that they did not want to do.
How far back do we have to go to find situations where the court has really overturned or wanted to overrule on economic regulation, on things that were considered covered as part of the Commerce Clause?
The 1930s. In fact, the Commerce Clause was the root of the fight between the Supreme Court and Franklin D. Roosevelt over the New Deal. That was really what was what they were fighting about. And I know that that it's what led to Roosevelt's ill-fated court packing plan, mm-hmm. that he was so angry about the Supreme Court decisions in the about the Commerce Clause. So there was a great historical resonance to this case, and it did have the same resolution, which was ultimately the Longs were upheld.
You begin the book by talking about the botched oath that Chief Justice Roberts administered to the president. Talk a little bit about that story.
Well, you know, this is one thing where I love to be a journalist, because, you know, there is stories pass so quickly, but no one ever bothers to go back and figure out what the heck happened. And so I went back and I looked at the story of the botched oath. And there's a real tale there, and that's why the book is called The Oath. It opens with it. You know, a lot of people at the time thought, oh gosh, you know, Roberts really didn't work hard. He just sort of blew off the whole thing. Quite the opposite was the case. In fact, he was so, he worked so hard on the oath, rehearsed it so many times, that his wife said to him, at this point, the dog thinks it's the president. It also shows, and the real reason Obama and Roberts were on the wrong page was that there was a misplaced email, that the email with the oath, the description of how the oath would be administered line by line, went to a secretary in the congressional committee supervising the inauguration, and that secretary never forwarded it to Obama's office. So the moral of the story is you should always open and read the attachments to get it work.
Right. One of the things that's interesting is that although there are so many similarities in their individual stories between Obama and Roberts, that there is no personal relationship at all between the two of them.
You know, famous people don't always know each other. And they've really met on a small handful of occasions. Roberts came to Obama's office for a courtesy call when Roberts was nominated to the Supreme Court and Obama was a senator. They met at the Supreme Court when the justices greeted Obama and Biden about 6 days before the inauguration. They've shaken hands on other occasions at the State of the Union, but there is no relationship to speak of.
Would it matter if there was?
Probably not much. These days, the personal relationships matter a lot less at the Supreme Court. The ethical rules are such that there is more of a separation from the judiciary than the legislature than there used to be. Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt used to play poker regularly with their buddies on the Supreme Court. Antonin Scalia got into trouble for going duck hunting with Dick Cheney. I didn't think it was significant or a problem, but I mean, again, it was indicative of how the rules have gotten stricter, even if they are sort of informal rules. So I don't. There's unlikely to be any significant personal relationship between them.
After the decision in the Obamacare case, there was lots of talk about John Roberts thinking about his legacy as a Chief Justice. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I think Roberts really does not want the court to be seen as a deeply partisan institution. I mean, this is sort of the paradox. He wants the court to be conservative and reach conservative results, but he doesn't want the court to be perceived that way. And I think that's something he struggles with, and I think it affected his vote in the Obamacare case. You know, it is true that Supreme Court decisions apply whether people like the Supreme Court or not, but it's also true that these justices, especially the Chief Justice, care about their institutional reputation, and so this stuff matters.
Is Roberts an originalist?
That's a hard question. I'm not sure. I don't think he would call himself an originalist. All of the justices, including the liberals, feel that there is a place for examining the original intent of the framers in determining what the Constitution means. But only Scalia and Thomas think it is the only and most important way of determining what the Constitution means. Now, that Roberts and Scalia still come out the same way in the result of most cases, but their mode of analysis, I think, is largely is somewhat different.
Mm-hmm. And talk about that in terms of precedent as well, and the willingness to overturn precedent. I mean, Roberts, even in his confirmation hearings, talked a lot about this and the whole idea of stare decisis.
You know, but here's where I think John Roberts is open for some criticism, because he made a big show during his mm-hmm. confirmation hearings of talking about how much he respected precedent. But I mean, one of the touchstones of the Roberts Court has been the great willingness to overturn precedent, and I think that's whether in Citizens United or in the gun control cases or in the school integration cases, there has been a lot of overturning of decisions.
Talk about Citizens United, because it was a case that basically went twice before the Supreme Court and got bigger the second time around.
It's an amazing story, Citizens United. There were so many different storylines going on over the course of that one case. There was it was Elena Kagan's first argument as Solicitor General. It was Sonia Sotomayor's first case as a Supreme Court justice. It was an odd set of facts about a movie about Hillary Clinton. It was a case that was re-argued, which is something that had not been done in 10 years. But I think, you know, what you saw was the conservatives on the Supreme Court at their most aggressive in Citizens United. And that's what the result really tells you.
What did they see that was worth being that aggressive about? What did they envision that this case could mean for their cause, essentially?
Well, certainly, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote it, has very absolutist views about the First Amendment, and he has an almost Pavlovian response whenever people make free speech claims to agree to it, and. You know, the metaphor everybody talks about in Citizens United is, you know, corporations are like people. But in fact, the metaphor that is more significant is that money is speech. And that if you really believe that spending money in a political campaign is identical to holding a picket sign or giving a talk, you have to deregulate American campaigns. And I think they've really only begun to strike down campaign finance regulations. So, there's been a lot of criticism of Citizens United, but this Supreme Court is deeply committed to it. There'll be more before there'll be less.
To what extent does Robert's background as a corporate litigator essentially play into this as well?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with the civil litigation cases they hear. You know, they don't get as much attention as the constitutional cases, but basically the Supreme Court gets a lot of cases every year about individuals suing corporations one way or another. And those cases have been routes for the corporations since John Roberts became Chief Justice. And a lot of them on, you know, procedural doctrines that sound boring, like standing, like statutes of limitations. But basically there are ways for judges to throw cases out of court sooner. And that's something Robert spent a lot of his time on as a private lawyer, and it's something that he has made a signature as Chief Justice.
In this coming term, we're looking at things involving affirmative action, the Voting Rights Act, gay marriage. What should we look for?
Well, I think the future of affirmative action is a very significant issue, and that was just argued last week. Mm-hmm. And I think it looks like the justices will do something to limit, if not overrule, affirmative action. That message seemed pretty clear. A future of the Voting Rights Act, similar possibility. More immigration cases. And, of course, the big unknown is whether they will take either the same-sex marriage case, the Proposition 8 case out of here in California, or the Defense of Marriage Act case out of Massachusetts. Those will be immensely important if the court takes them.
But Justice Kennedy's position on those issues is one that might lead to a different conclusion in those cases.
Well, when it comes to gay rights, Anthony Kennedy, it's been one of the few areas where he has consistently sided with the liberals. In fact, he's the author of the court's two most important gay rights decisions, Lawrence v. Texas and the Romer case out of Colorado. So I think there's a lot of hope for liberals to get Kennedy's vote in the Defense of Marriage Act case. I think the Proposition 8 case they will probably try to stay away from because they are not prepared to simply impose same-sex marriage, I don't think they are, in the whole country, even in the states that haven't approved it. So, you know, that I think is something that they really don't want to do yet.
Do you think that the court has been much of an issue? It doesn't seem that it has in the current election. And should it be, given that three of the justices are all in their mid-70s?
Four. Ginsburg is 79, Scalia and Kennedy are 76, Breyer is 74. I think the Obamacare decision coming out the way it did took the air out of the Supreme Court as a political issue for the Democrats, but of course it should be a more important issue. You know, this is a president's most important legacy, or close to it. These justices will shape the Constitution for decades. Abortion, civil rights, immigration, gay rights, all those issues will wind up before the Supreme Court, and presidents get to put their stamp on it, and it will be enormously significant.
Jeffrey Toobin, the book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.